Welcome to another dive. This time, we're tackling a subject that I know a lot of you are curious about, biblical prophecy.
It's one of those topics that always seems to generate a lot of questions.
Right, like how do we even begin to interpret those sometimes really cryptic writings? And to help us untangle all of that, we have our expert here.
Happy to be here.
So let's start with the basics. When we talk about prophecy in the Bible, what are we really talking about? What's its main purpose? Is it just about knowing the future?
Well, it can seem that way on the surface. You read these predictions and you think, okay, this is what's going to happen. But it's actually much deeper than that.
Oh, definitely. So it's not just about like having this crystal ball and seeing specific dates and events.
Right. It's not about giving us a play-by-play of what's to come. Instead, it's more about revealing God's hand in history, showing how he's guiding things toward a specific goal.
So it's less about the specific details and more about understanding God's overarching plan. That makes sense. Now, one thing that often trips people up is the whole prophecy versus history debate. Some folks see them as basically the same thing, either history disguised as prediction or vice versa. What do those viewpoints get wrong?
Well, I think the key is to recognize that prophecy and history are distinct literary forms. You can't just lump them together.
Okay, I like that. Distinct literary form. So it's like comparing, I don't know, a poem to a news report. They both convey information, but in very different ways and with different purposes.
Exactly. That's a great analogy.
So let's break that down a bit. First up, what about the idea that prophecy is just history disguised as prediction? How does that miss the mark?
This view often overlooks the, what we might call, the enigmatic nature of prophecy. Unlike history, which aims to present a clear chronological account of events, prophecy is intentionally veiled.
Okay, so it's like we're getting a sneak peek, but not the whole picture.
That's a great way to put it. Like you're getting hints, not the full storyline.
Like a movie trailer. Enough to get you interested, but not to spoil the whole plot.
Precisely. There's this great quote from scholar A. Berkeley Nicholson. He said, "Any man who could write history in the form of Hebrew prophecy would have to forget half of what he knew in order to give the appearance of being a prophet."
Whoa, that's pretty powerful. It's like the prophet's intentionally leaving out details to create that sense of mystery and anticipation.
Right. It adds to the impact when the prophecy ultimately unfolds.
What about the other side of the coin? What's wrong with seeing prophecy as just like history written beforehand?
Well, that idea also ignores the unique characteristics of prophetic writing. Prophecy isn't meant to give us this comprehensive chronological account of everything that's going to happen.
So we're not talking about like a time traveler writing a history textbook from the future.
No, not at all. Instead, think of it as a partial, sometimes symbolic view, just enough to recognize it when it's being fulfilled, but often with those unexpected twists and turns.
Could you give us a concrete example from the Bible to illustrate this difference between prophecy and history?
Absolutely. Let's look at Isaiah 9, which talks about a light dawning in a very specific region, and then jump ahead to its fulfillment in Matthew 4.
Okay, so Isaiah 9, the light shining in the darkness. What's the historical backdrop when this prophecy is given? What's going on in the world?
So picture this. It's a time of intense turmoil for the kingdoms of Israel and Judah. Assyria's on the move, conquering regions, plunging them into darkness, literally and figuratively. And in the midst of all this chaos, Isaiah delivers this prophecy about a great light that will eventually shine in this specific region that's fallen under Assyrian control, the land of Zebulun and Naphtali.
And then, centuries later, we see this prophecy play out in a very real and tangible way, right?
Exactly. Matthew 4 describes Jesus beginning his ministry in Galilee, the very same region that Isaiah had prophesied about centuries earlier. And Matthew makes a clear connection between this event and the fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy. The light that Isaiah spoke of, it turns out, was Jesus himself.
That's a pretty incredible point. You mentioned earlier that prophecy has this enigmatic element. What's enigmatic about this particular prophecy?
Well, Isaiah doesn't specify how this light will appear. He doesn't say a child will be born or a king will arise. He simply proclaims the coming of a light.
So the how is intentionally left unsaid. It's like a surprise waiting to be revealed.
Exactly. And that adds to the sense of wonder and awe when the prophecy ultimately comes true. It's like a mystery unfolding before your eyes.
It's like the prophet's giving us the destination, but not the detailed map to get there. It makes the journey so much more impactful when we finally arrive. Now, thinking about our listener, I bet they're wondering how all these prophecies fit together in the big scheme of things, because it's not like the Bible just throws out random predictions here and there. There seems to be a bigger picture emerging, right?
You're absolutely right. It's not just a random collection of predictions. The Bible reveals these prophetic themes gradually, building on previous revelations. We call this process progressive revelation.
Progressive revelation. So it's like we're assembling a puzzle, and each piece we get gives us a clearer picture of the overall image.
Exactly. Later prophecies often add to or clarify earlier ones, giving us a more complete picture as time goes on.
Do you have a really solid example of this progressive revelation in action?
Oh, definitely. One of the classic examples is the concept of the Antichrist.
Okay, so the Antichrist, where do we first encounter this figure in Scripture? Where does this idea start to take shape?
We get those initial hints in Daniel 7. This figure is depicted as a little horn that opposes God's people.
Okay, a little horn. Sounds ominous. And then as we're moving through the book of Daniel, does that picture become a little more detailed?
Absolutely. In Daniel 9 and 12, we get more specifics about this little horn's actions and characteristics.
Okay, so we're starting to get a better sense of who this figure is and what they represent. And then when we get to the New Testament, does the image become even more defined?
Exactly. Paul in 2 Thessalonians 2 speaks of the man of sin who exalts himself above God, even setting himself up in the temple. And then finally in Revelation 13, we encounter the beast who shares some striking similarities with the little horn to Daniel.
So with each new revelation, the picture of the Antichrist becomes clearer, more defined. It's like each layer adds depth and detail to the portrait. But you mentioned earlier that even with this progressive unveiling, there's still some ambiguity. Why is that?
Well, that's the nature of prophecy. It often leaves room for interpretation, for debate. Even with those added details, you know, there could be layers of meaning, symbolism that invites us to really think critically. It keeps us engaged with the text.
That's what makes it so fascinating. It's like an ongoing conversation, inviting us to grapple with these complex ideas and try to understand the bigger picture. Speaking of the bigger picture, I'm sure our listener is wondering about the timeline of all these predicted events. How do we make sense of the timing, especially since prophecies don't usually give us specific dates?
That's a great question. And it brings us to something called the prophetic time perspective. You see, the prophets weren't bound by our linear understanding of time. They could perceive events separated by centuries as if they were happening all at once.
Wow, so they weren't looking at a calendar and marking off specific years or dates. It was more like a panoramic view of history, right?
Precisely. Imagine looking at a mountain range from a distance. The peaks might look all clustered together, but in reality, they're miles apart.
I like that. It's like a visual representation of how time might appear from a prophetic perspective.
Exactly. So events that seem close together in a prophecy might actually be separated by huge spans of time. We call this the foreshortening effect.
Do you have a biblical example that demonstrates this foreshortening?
Sure. Look at Isaiah 61.1-2. It mentions both the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance, seemingly right next to each other as if they were happening back to back. But then in Luke 4, Jesus quotes the first part of that passage, proclaiming its fulfillment during his earthly ministry.
So Jesus is saying, hey, the year of the Lord's favor is here, but he doesn't mention the day of vengeance.
Right, that indicates there's a clear gap between those two events, even though Isaiah presented them as occurring very close together.
It's like the prophet is zooming in on certain key moments without giving us the entire timeline. It creates a sense of mystery and anticipation.
Exactly. And it's amazing how much is packed into even a single sentence of prophecy.
Now let's talk about something that I think a lot of people find challenging about prophecy, the language. It's filled with ancient terms and imagery that can be really hard to grasp from our modern perspective. Like, how do we make sense of prophecies that talk about, say, horses and chariots when we live in an age of tanks and drones?
Right. It can be a bit of a head scratcher. It's like trying to decode a message from a different world. And there are actually a few different approaches to tackling this.
Well, let's dive into those approaches because I think this is where a lot of people get tripped up. What are some ways we can approach this tricky language?
One approach is to insist on a very literal fulfillment, even when it comes to those specific images used. So if a prophecy mentions horses and chariots, they expect to see those exact things at the time of fulfillment.
No room for metaphor or symbolism there. It's like taking it word for word no matter what.
Exactly. But this approach can sometimes lead to problems because it doesn't always consider the cultural context. You know, the prophets were speaking to their own time, using language and imagery that their audience would have understood.
Right, like if a prophet today was trying to describe a future event using technology that hasn't even been invented yet, it would be super confusing. We need to put ourselves in the shoes of the original audience, right?
Absolutely. Think about trying to explain, say, a smartphone to someone living in the Middle Ages. They wouldn't even have the concepts to understand it.
So we need that balance between respecting the literal words and also understanding how those words would have been understood by the people who first heard them.
Exactly. Now, the second approach is what some call spiritualization.
Okay, spiritualization. So we're talking about interpreting those images and symbols in a more metaphorical or allegorical way.
Right. This approach sees the prophecy as entirely symbolic of spiritual realities, often downplaying or even ignoring any connection to actual physical events.
So instead of expecting literal horses and chariots, we might see them as representing, say, spiritual warfare or the spread of the gospel.
That's it. But this approach also has limitations, right? Because by focusing fully on the spiritual meaning, we might overlook the prophecy's potential connection to real-world events.
So it's like we need to find that balance between the literal and the symbolic, the physical and the spiritual. What's the third approach? How else can we understand this kind of language?
The third approach focuses on finding modern equivalents or correspondences for those ancient terms. This approach acknowledges that, yes, there's figurative language in prophecy, but it's often referring to real, tangible things, just in a way that would have made sense to the original audience.
So instead of expecting literal horses and chariots, we might look for their modern-day counterparts, things that serve a similar function or purpose.
Exactly. So chariots might correspond to our modern-day tanks or armored vehicles. Bows and arrows might represent missile systems. And instead of assuming that ancient nations like Moab or Edom will literally reappear, we might look for modern nations or entities that occupy those same geographic areas or play similar roles in global affairs.
So we're not looking for those things to come back exactly as they were, but rather to find their modern equivalents, the things that fulfill a similar role in our world today.
That's it. It's about recognizing the underlying concepts more than getting fixated on the specific words, because those concepts often transcend time and culture.
Do we have a passage that illustrates how these different approaches might play out in practice?
Oh, absolutely. Isaiah 11:10-14 is a great example. It's a passage packed with vivid imagery. You've got the gathering of exiles, the vanquishing of enemies like Edom and Moab, and even the drying up of the Euphrates River.
A lot going on there. I bet our listeners are already starting to think about how those different approaches would interpret that passage.
Well, let's start with the spiritualization approach. One scholar, E.J. Young, sees the gathering of exiles not as a literal return of Jewish exile to their homeland, but as representing people from all nations coming to faith in Christ.
Ah, so he's interpreting it through a Christian lens, seeing it as foreshadowing the global spread of the church and the unity of believers from diverse backgrounds.
Exactly. For Young, the primary focus isn't on predicting specific political events, but on understanding the bigger picture of God's plan for redemption and the establishment of his kingdom.
But I imagine some people might say, hold on, what about the literal meaning of the text? Isaiah is talking about real nations and real places.
You're right, and that's where those other approaches offer different perspectives. Those who favor a more literal interpretation might see this passage as predicting a future time when Israel will be restored to its land and will experience victory over its enemies.
So for them, the emphasis is on a physical and political restoration of Israel, with the vanquishing of enemies representing a real military victory.
Exactly. And then you have the approach that seeks to find modern equivalents. This one would look for those modern nations or entities that occupy those same geographical areas, or that play similar roles on the world stage today.
So instead of expecting ancient Edom and Moab to suddenly reappear, we might look for their modern-day counterparts, the nations that occupy those same territories or exhibit similar behaviors.
Precisely. And that drying up of the Euphrates River, that could represent a major shift in power dynamics in the Middle East, maybe the decline of a current superpower or the rise of a new one.
So each approach offers a unique lens through which to view the passage, and they're not necessarily mutually exclusive.
That's right. It's possible to hold a nuanced view that acknowledges both the literal and symbolic aspects of the prophecy, recognizing that it could have multiple layers of meaning, and that those meanings might unfold in different ways over time.
And that's what makes studying prophecy so exciting. It's this ongoing exploration, challenging us to grapple with those different layers of meaning, those different perspectives, and to try to understand how they all fit together.
It's a journey, for sure.
Well, this has been a fantastic start to our deep dive. But before we get too far ahead of ourselves, let's take a pause here. We'll be back soon to continue exploring the fascinating world of biblical prophecy. Welcome back. Before the break, we were really getting into some of the challenges of interpreting prophecy, especially when it comes to understanding that ancient language. We talked about those three main approaches, the literal, the spiritualization approach, and then that idea of finding modern-day equivalents. And I'm thinking it might help our listener to see how those approaches actually work in practice. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. A passage like Isaiah 11:10-14 that we were just looking at is perfect for this. Remember all that imagery. Gathering exiles, defeating enemies like Edom and Moab, even the Euphrates River drying up. It's a lot to unpack.
Yeah, it's a pretty dense passage. I can imagine our listener reading that and thinking, okay, what am I supposed to do with this? Am I supposed to take it literally, or is there like a deeper symbolic meaning here?
Right, and that's where those different approaches come in. Remember, we talked about E.J. Young's spiritualization view earlier. He sees that gathering of exiles not as a physical return to the land of Israel, but as people from all nations coming to faith in Christ. They're forming this unified body of believers.
So he's interpreting it through a very Christian lens, right? Seeing it as kind of foreshadowing the global spread of the church.
Exactly. For Young, the vanquishing of enemies represents overcoming spiritual opposition, not literal warfare. And that Euphrates River drying up, that symbolizes the removal of barriers to the gospel. It's about that free flow of God's message throughout the world.
It's a really interesting way to look at it, but I'm sure some people would push back on that and say, wait a minute, Isaiah is clearly talking about real places, real nations. What about the literal meaning of the text?
You're right, and that's where those other approaches can help us see things from different angles. Those who favor a more literal interpretation, they might see this passage as predicting a future time when Israel is restored to its land and experiences a decisive victory over its enemies.
So for them, the emphasis is on a physical and political restoration, with the defeat of enemies being a very real, very tangible military victory.
Precisely. And then we have that approach that focuses on finding modern-day equivalents. This view would look for nations or entities today that occupy those same geographical areas or play similar roles in the world.
So instead of expecting ancient Edom or Moab to literally come back on the scene, we'd look for their modern-day counterparts, the nations that are in those territories today, or maybe that exhibit similar characteristics or behaviors.
Right. And the drying up of the Euphrates, that could symbolize a major shift in those power dynamics in the Middle East, maybe the weakening or collapse of a modern empire.
It seems like there's room for like a multi-layered understanding. Maybe those different layers of meaning unfold over different periods in history. It's kind of mind-blowing when you think about it.
It is. And it highlights how rich and deep prophetic literature is. It's not just about, you know, predicting specific events. It's about revealing God's character, his plan for the world, and how we fit into that bigger story.
Speaking of that prophetic perspective, I want to circle back to something you said earlier, that idea that the prophets experienced those future events as if they were happening in the present. That's such a fascinating concept. It's like they were transported through time, witnessing those events firsthand.
It really is. It helps explain why they could describe these future events so vividly, often using the past tense as if it had already happened.
Right, like in Isaiah 61.1-2, where he talks about both the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance, as if they were already happening. And then we saw how Jesus quoted that first part, declaring its fulfillment in his ministry, but the day of vengeance is still ahead of us.
Exactly. And that just reinforces the idea that the prophets weren't limited by our typical understanding of time. They could see this vast panorama of history, past, present, and future, all sort of merging together.
It's like they were standing on a mountaintop, overlooking this vast landscape of time and seeing it all at once, which raises a pretty profound question. If these biblical prophets could perceive events centuries into the future, what does that tell us about the direction of history and about our own place in it?
That's a big question. It suggests that history isn't just a random series of events. It's unfolding according to a plan, a divine plan. And if that's the case, then our lives have real meaning and purpose within that grand scheme.
So studying prophecy isn't just this intellectual exercise. It can actually impact how we see our lives, how we understand our role in the world. It invites us to see ourselves as part of something much bigger, a story that's been unfolding since the beginning of time, and that's still moving toward its ultimate conclusion.
Beautiful put. It's like we're characters in this grand cosmic drama, and the script has already been written, but we have the freedom to choose how we'll play our parts.
I love that analogy. It captures that tension between God's sovereignty and human responsibility. It reminds us that we have a part to play and that our choices matter.
Exactly. We're not just passive observers. We're active participants.
You know, we've talked a lot about the challenges of interpreting prophecy, but I think those challenges are part of what makes it so rewarding. It forces us to dig deeper, to wrestle with those complex ideas, to really engage with the text, and to come away with a much richer understanding of God and his plan.
Couldn't agree more. It's a journey. And the deeper we go, the more we discover.
Now, we've been focusing a lot on that big picture, the overall sweep of prophecy and its implications for history. But I think it's important to bring it down to a more personal level. How can we, as individuals, apply these insights about prophecy to our own lives? What practical takeaways can we glean from these ancient texts?
That's the question, isn't it? How do we take this ancient wisdom and make it relevant to our lives today? For me, one of the biggest takeaways is that reminder that God is in control. Even when the world seems chaotic and unpredictable, we can be confident that he's working out his purposes. He's moving history toward its ultimate goal.
So it's an antidote to fear, to anxiety. In a world that's often filled with so much uncertainty, prophecy offers a sense of hope, of stability.
Exactly. And it leads to another key application, living with a sense of expectancy. If we really believe God's promises will be fulfilled, that His kingdom will ultimately triumph, then we should live with that eager anticipation of what's to come.
So it's not just about understanding the past or predicting the future, but about living in the present with that sense of purpose, of direction, knowing that we're part of something so much bigger than ourselves.
Precisely. Prophecy calls us to live differently, to make choices that align with God's will, and they contribute to the advancement of His kingdom.
That's such a powerful reminder. Prophecy isn't just about those abstract theological concepts or those distant future events. It's about how we live our lives today in light of what God has revealed about His plans and purposes.
I couldn't agree more. It's about aligning our hearts and minds with God's heart and mind, allowing His vision for the future to shape our actions and decisions right now in the present moment.
Now, we spent a lot of time talking about those different approaches to interpreting prophetic language, but I'm thinking it would be helpful for our listener to have some practical tools for navigating those tricky passages. What are some things they can keep in mind when they encounter those ancient terms and images? What advice would you give?
That's so important. You're right. We need to give them something to work with. Okay, so here are a few guidelines that I've found helpful. First, remember that historical and cultural context. Try to put yourself in the shoes of the original audience. How do they live? What do they value? What were their modes of transportation? How do they wage war?
So instead of getting hung up on the literal meaning of chariots or swords, we need to think about what those things represented: power, speed, military might, and then ask ourselves, okay, what are the modern day equivalents of those concepts?
Exactly. Instead of expecting to see literal chariots rolling across a battlefield, we might look for tanks, fighter jets, you know, even cyber warfare. It's about grasping those underlying concepts, not getting stuck on specific words.
Makes sense. What other tips do you have?
Another one is to pay close attention to the literary genre. Is it poetry, narrative, apocalyptic literature? Each genre has its own conventions, its own way of using language, and that can really guide our interpretation.
So we wouldn't expect the same level of literal precision in a highly symbolic book like Revelation as we would in a historical narrative like the Book of Kings.
Right. And don't forget that prophecy often operates on those multiple levels of meaning. A single passage might have both a literal and a symbolic meaning, or it might have several fulfillments throughout history.
So it's not about picking the one right interpretation, but understanding that there could be many layers of meaning, and those layers might unfold in different ways over time.
Precisely. And finally, maybe most importantly, approach prophecy with humility and an open mind. We don't have all the answers. There's always room to keep learning, to keep reflecting, and even to disagree respectfully.
It's about letting the text challenge us, expand our understanding, and deepen our faith.
Well said. It's an ongoing journey. And the more we engage with these texts, the more we're going to discover.
This has been such an insightful conversation. We've explored the purpose of prophecy, how it's different from history, that idea of progressive revelation, the unique way time is viewed in those prophetic writings, and even those challenges of interpreting that ancient language. I hope our listener feels a little more equipped to understand and engage with those really fascinating parts of Scripture.
I hope so, too. It's a subject that I think should spark a lot of curiosity and wonder in all of us.
You know, what really struck me throughout our discussion is that sheer scope of God's plan. Prophecy gives us a glimpse into that plan. It reminds us that He's orchestrating events, moving history towards its ultimate destination.
It really is awe-inspiring to think about. And it reminds us that even when things feel chaotic and uncertain, we can trust that God is in control. He's working out His purposes.
It's a message of hope, a beacon of light in a world that often feels shrouded in darkness. And it challenges us to live differently, to align our lives with God's will, and to participate in His work of redemption in the world.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Prophecy isn't just about understanding the past or predicting the future. It's about living in the present with that sense of purpose, that sense of direction, knowing that we're part of something much bigger than ourselves.
And on that note, I think it's time for us to take a quick break. But don't worry, we'll be right back to wrap up our deep dive into the world of biblical prophecy. And we're back for the final stretch of our deep dive into biblical prophecy. It's been a fascinating journey so far, lots of twists and turns, and some really mind-blowing insights.
It really have. Always a pleasure to explore these deeper layers of meaning. Prophecy never gets old.
Okay, so before we wrap things up, I want to make sure we bring it all home for our listener. You know, we've been unpacking a lot. Prophecy's purpose, how it's distinct from history, that gradual unfolding of God's plan, the whole time perspective thing, and even the challenges of interpreting that ancient language. But the big question is, what does all of this mean for us practically? How can we take these insights and actually apply them to our lives?
That's the million-dollar question, right? Because knowledge without application, well, it's kind of like a seed that never gets planted. It's got all this potential, but it never really bears fruit.
So how do we plant those seeds? What are some of the key takeaways that our listener can put into practice?
Well, for me, one of the most powerful takeaways is that reminder that even when things seem totally out of control, God is still in control. He's still working out his purposes. He's moving history toward its ultimate destination.
So it's like an antidote to that feeling of being overwhelmed by everything that's going on in the world. Prophecy gives us that bigger perspective, right? It reassures us that God has a plan, even if we can't always grasp it in the moment.
Absolutely. And that leads to another key application, living with a sense of expectancy. If we truly believe that God will keep his promises, that his kingdom will ultimately win out in the end, then we should be approaching life with a sense of anticipation, not just sitting back and waiting, but actively preparing for what's to come.
It's about letting that future hope shape how we live in the present, aligning ourselves with God's purposes, playing our part in this unfolding story of redemption.
That's beautifully put. It reminds me of those ancient prophets. They weren't just passively receiving visions. They were actively proclaiming God's message, intervening in events.
They were agents of change.
Exactly. Think about Daniel. He was interpreting dreams for kings, speaking truth to power, even when it meant putting his own life at risk. Or Esther, who used her position to protect her people from genocide. Their lives show us that understanding prophecy isn't just about gaining head knowledge, it's about being transformed by that knowledge and letting it fuel our actions.
That's a powerful message. And I think it's a great place to wrap up our deep dive. We've covered a lot of ground here, exploring prophecy from all angles, and hopefully our listener feels empowered to continue that exploration. But before we sign off, I want to leave you with one final thought to chew on. We've talked about how God's plan is unfolding throughout history, moving toward that grand finale. But within that bigger story, each of us has a unique role to play. It's like we're each given a single brushstroke to contribute to this vast, intricate masterpiece.
That's a beautiful image. It reminds us that our lives have meaning, not just today, but for eternity.
So as you keep wrestling with these ideas, keep asking yourself, what's my part in all of this? What brushstroke is God calling me to make?
Those are questions worth pondering, because the answers can change everything.
They really can. And with that, dear listener, it's time for us to say goodbye. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the fascinating world of biblical prophecy. We hope you've gained some valuable insights and maybe even a renewed sense of wonder at the God who holds the future in his hands.